My name is Michael Pellet, and I teach in the philosophy department at the University of Saskatchewan in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, and I'm also serving as pastor at King of Glory Lutheran Church in Saskatoon. And this week, for our Bible study, the theme is trying to read the Gospel of Mark and look at some particular sections with our summer theme in mind, no longer strangers, and that sense of Mark's understanding of community and what does it mean to be a community of faith, a community of discipleship. And we've looked at some of that to see that for Mark there are themes of insiders and outsiders, and how for Mark the gospel works in a way to make outsiders insiders, but also because of the kinds of resistance and denial of that gospel at work in our lives, it could also make insiders outsiders. And there is that kind of resistance to the way God's rule and reign and dynamics is at work in our life. And so we've examined some of those understandings and some of the places where Mark becomes very controversial, because Mark's understanding of community is a critique and an alternative to the kinds of community and ways of organization and styles of leadership with which we are familiar. It is very critical of notions of domination and hierarchical leadership, and understands leadership in terms of service. It's critical, think of understandings of our own political organizations and even familial organizations, and understands the way in which we live together as God's people in terms of those who do and practice the will of God, and an understanding of God's unconditionality of grace and the kind of, if you will, economics and politics of grace that is at work in that. Today, as we look at the Gospel of Mark, if we'd have lots of time, like until supper this evening, we would be able to look at this whole section. Chapter 6, verse 30 through chapter 8, verse 21, because that's, I think, again, one of the sections in Mark that is, again, working with a notion of inclusivity. And what we have here at the beginning and ending of this section is the feeding of the 5,000 and the feeding of the 4,000. Mark kind of uses the geography of Palestine to set this up. If this is Galilee, and this is the Sea of Galilee, and this is the Dead Sea, here's the Jordan River. Mark is working in this gospel, not in terms of saying there are certain things that are happening on the Jewish side of the lake, and there are certain things that are happening on the Gentile side of the lake. So that the feeding of the 5,000 happens on the Jewish side, the 4,000 happens on the Gentile side. There is also hardness of heart that happens on the Jewish side, and hardness of heart that happens on the Gentile side. The interesting thing is that it's the same characters that have hard hearts on both sides, namely the disciples. And so here again we have this terrific Markan irony that the disciples, who you would think are the insiders, end up at the end here in verse 21 as truly the outsiders. They're the ones that don't get it. And at the end of this session, just to get you all worried now in advance, I will have a little handout and quiz for some of you to see if you get it or don't get it. But don't worry about that later. That's just, you know, just to make you pay attention a little bit. Anxiety always works wonders. Okay. But we have that contract. between the Jewish side and the Gentile side, of course, there is going to be a crossing of the lake. And this is going to be a very stormy crossing. And so we have a storm crossing here. And if our time permits, we'll look at that. As well, having crossed the lake, again, there will be a Jewish and Gentile set up in these middle chapters, or this middle section between the feedings. And again, the controversy here will always be over the community's practice of inclusivity. On the Jewish side, it's when, again, the officials from Jerusalem come and criticize Jesus about eating with defiled hands and not keeping the proper ritual practices and purity and just letting all those unclean folks be part of it. And so there's going to be that talk again about inclusivity. Over here on the Gentile side of inclusivity, it deals with healing stories, and particularly the healing story of the Canaanite woman, where again Jesus says, well, I've come for the people of Israel, and you know, it's not fair to take food from children and toss it to the dogs. And she says, yes, but even the dogs get the crumbs that fall from the table. And Jesus responds, great is your faith. So a notion of inclusivity that goes on there. Because of time, everything else, I'm not even going to talk about this center section. But just to let you know, it's there. Last week, I did talk about the Canaanite woman in a section on community that I did last week. So if you want to, you know, if it's a rainy day and you need something to help ease your insomnia, you can get that. It was my second session last week on dwelling at the margins. It was called the edge or wedge of community, and talking about how a community lives on the boundaries of this whole issue of inclusivity.
I'm late for this first.
May I see your tardy slip, ma'am?
Oh, I ate it.
No, it's my computer crashed. My computer crashed. Anyway, so I did use the story of the Canaanite woman in that other session to talk about that. What I want to do today is particularly concentrate on either side of the lake here in terms of the two feeding stories and begin to look at what they have to tell us about community. And so, to begin there, if you would please turn to Mark chapter 6, and the opening of this story, beginning at verses 30 through verse 34. So if someone would read verses 30 through 34, please.
The apostles gathered around Jesus and told him all that they had done and taught. He said to them, come away to a deserted place all by yourselves and rest a while. For many were coming and going, and they had no leisure even to eat. And they went away in the boat to a deserted place by themselves. Now many saw them going and recognized them, and they hurried there on foot from all the towns and arrived ahead of them. And he went ashore, and he saw a great crowd, and he had compassion for them, because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And he began to teach them many things.
Okay. Anything in those four verses that kind of strike you as interesting, odd, important?
Yes. People on foot beat them to their wilderness spot.
Okay, so that yeah, isn't that kind of funny that somehow right, somehow my marker is right, and somehow the crowd gets there ahead of Jesus. Now let's put the crowd. Right. The crowd is leading the way. Anything else?
How did they know where to go?
How did they know where to go?
Where you at?
Well, the crowd went on foot. Jesus and the disciples went by boat.
Yeah, which is even crazier because they took the fast form of transportation and the crowd still got there ahead of them. Anything else? Well, I'll explain that in...
They were trying to go to a deserted place.
Yeah.
And it turns out that...
Yeah, they wanted to go to the deserted place, and there's the crowd. And again, that whole notion of the deserted place, a notion of wilderness.
He had compassion for them.
Had compassion for them. Okay, anything else? Right. One of the things I think that's going on here again, in our, we'll see in our little insider-outsider reversal thing, is how does the story start out? We again have Jesus at the center, and his apostles gather around him, and then, you know, there's kind of the crowds coming and going and all that. In many senses, that's the way it should be, right? Jesus, the disciples, then the outside. But somehow, the crowd gets ahead of them and all of that stuff, and by the end of the story, we'll end up again with Jesus in the center, the crowd around him, and the apostles and the disciples will be there on the outside. So that as we look at this journey and this transition, one of the things that I think we as readers need to keep in mind is what happened that the apostles, who, right, they just came back, chapter 6, the beginning of chapter 6, is the great commissioning, and right, they've been sent out two by two, and they've done all these wonderful things, and they've come back here in verse 30 telling Jesus about all their successes. And Jesus, before McDonald's ever came along, said, hey, you deserve a break today. And so they were going to go for holiday out to this quiet resort called Holden, right, in the wilderness, and all the crowds get there ahead of them. And all sorts of crazy things happen. So there's already in the beginnings of this story, as we set this up, there's this reversal. There's also, again, note the change in plans. What had supposedly started out as being a quiet retreat for Jesus and his disciples ends up again as teaching ministry with the crowds. I think part of this notion here again about the crowds going on ahead of them. In Mark, this notion of going on ahead almost serves as a technical term for his notion of leadership, because he often refers to Jesus as going on ahead of the disciples or of those who are around him. Now, interestingly enough, the crowd is going on ahead. In some senses, again, the notion of who sets the agenda in a community. Is it kind of a top-down thing where the leader says, okay, I am the leader, and here's what we're going to do today, step one, step two, step three, or is the agenda or even leadership itself and needs kind of generated out of the community? That Jesus responds, again, a sense of service or compassion. And this is, again, going to be very important. But Jesus responds to the needs and the issues that are there as generated by the crowd, if you will, as generated by the community, by those who need help. And so again, it's a particular kind of leadership style that, if you've been with me earlier this week, has again been categorized by Mark as service, as that kind of table waiting, that kind of providing which Mark has seen women doing and holds up as the way of operating and helping. So we have that. The technical word for that is translated as compassion. The Greek word for that is marvelous. It's an onomatopoetic word, and I better stand back because you can hardly say it in Greek without spitting. So I'm going to stand back. It's esplanchthizomai. There's a, like a G-X-T-H-N to get, right? Try and say that. No, don't try and say that. Just think about saying, try saying a G-X-T-H-N all together, right? And your mouth kind of goes, right? Which is what it should do. Because literally, esplanchthizomai is talking about how one's bowels are tied up in knots. Or in classical Greek, technically, this term refers to a woman's womb in contraction. So any of you mothers, if you have the courage to think back about birthing experience and your womb in contraction, understand very well what having your guts tied up in knots are all about. That's the feeling Jesus has for the crowds. And that term is expressed, if you will, on the Jewish side in feeding the 5,000 and on the Gentile side in feeding the 4,000. I think it's the most important word in both of these stories. Because what Mark is doing, and I think here for us as a community, is that what Mark wants to present here through Jesus and using the disciples as a foil is an economics and politics of compassion. Do we as communities of faith practice an economics and politics of compassion? Or do we practice the business as usual economics and politics of the culture out there around us, which is an economics and politics basically of control, of domination, and of self-preservation? And so that's the juxtaposition that's here. Compassion over against our usual ways of domination, control, and self-preservation.
Can you give us an example of a community you see doing the economies and politics of compassion?
Let's wait with that for a while, and maybe you can give us some. Also, this notion of compassion and sheep without a shepherd. Some references from the Hebrew scriptures about that. There are many. There are some. Let me find my right notes here. In Jeremiah chapter 23, Zechariah chapter 11, and I think the key one here is Ezekiel chapter 34. And just to get a flavor of that, if someone would read for us Ezekiel chapter 34, verses 1 to 5. It goes on throughout the whole chapter, and maybe on your own you want to look at that. But if someone would please read Ezekiel chapter 34, verses 1 through 5, or 1 through 6.
The word of the Lord came to me, son of man, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. Prophesy and say to them, even to the shepherds, thus says the Lord God, O shepherds of Israel, who have been feeding yourselves, should not shepherds feed the sheep? You eat the fat, you clothe yourselves with the wool, you slaughter the fatlings, but you do not feed the sheep. The weak you have not strengthened, the sick you have not healed, the crippled you have not bound up, the strayed you have not brought back, the lost you have not sought, and with force and harshness you have ruled them. So they were scattered because there was no shepherd, and they became food for all the wild beasts. My sheep were scattered. They wandered over all the mountains and on every high hill. My sheep were scattered over all the face of the earth, with none to search or seek for them.
Okay, and it goes on and on. Just one more verse here to add to this, verse 16, where he says, I will seek the lost, and I will bring back the strayed, and I will bind up the injured, and I will strengthen the weak, but the fat and the strong I will destroy. I will feed them with justice. And so here too, I think the link in economics and politics of compassion, Mark is going to claim, is truly the way, again, in which one practices justice. Note again, if for those of you who were reading along, and that if you'd have to summarize it, what's the indictment that Ezekiel is leveling against the shepherds of Israel? What are they doing?
They're consuming it themselves.
Yeah, they're feeding themselves. And what are they doing to the sheep?
Abandoning
them, letting them go, or maybe even a little worse, to paraphrase it, they're feeding themselves while they're fleecing the sheep. Right? Isn't that what Ezekiel says they're doing? I mean, right, the Reader's Digest, abridged version of this chapter would say, feed yourselves, fleece your sheep. Okay, next chapter. Right? That's what's happening. And I think, right, Mark in these feeding stories as well, Jesus has compassion for these crowds. They're sheep without a shepherd because what's their situation? Supposedly they're shepherds, whether these are the religious authorities from Jerusalem and their economics and politics, or the Roman authorities from Jerusalem or wherever too, and their economics and politics, what are they doing? Feeding themselves, fleecing the sheep. I think the question for us in terms of us and our economics and politics is the kind of economics and politics that you participated, ha-ha, because I'm from Canada now, I can say you participated in the good old U.S. of A.
Oh, you said North America the other day.
I know, but I'm changing that now. I'm going to be a righteous one. It is North America. It is North America.
I'm just teasing.
Is our economic and political system truly designed that we end up feeding ourselves and fleecing others? Both within our countries and within the world? And do we as church, at least institutionally, adapt that same kind of economic and political system? Or are we truly an alternative community with an economics and politics which we practice that does feed sheep? And let's not just spiritualize that away, but let's not just think about that as food banks. It's a both and. Remember, Jesus is teaching these crowds and is concerned that they're hungry. And so that our economics and politics of compassion always involves both. That to split those things is just a false dichotomy. Right. We need both. As whole human beings, the whole human being is part of that economics and politics of compassion. And are our churches, are our communities of faith engaged in that? Or are we too still in systems of domination, control, self-preservation, so on and so forth, right? That's the question. How does Mark raise this question in this feeding story? If someone would please read verses 35 through 38. of chapter 6. Yes, chapter 6, verses 35 to 38.
Jesus said to them, I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never be hungry.
I'm sorry. Mark chapter.
I got John. I slipped. Okay.
But that's a bread chapter, too. There's just so much bread in the Gospels.
When it grew late, his disciples came to him and said, this is a deserted place, and the hour is now very late. Send them away so that they may go into the surrounding country and villages and buy something for themselves to eat. But he answered them, you give them something to eat. They said to him, are we to go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give it to them to eat? And he said to them, how many loaves have you? Go and see. When they had found out, they said, 5 and 2 fish.
Okay. Now, if you're a real, real, real careful reader of Mark, there is something tremendously funny going on here. And that is, if you go all the way back to chapter 6, verse 8. This is the sending out of the 12, where he ordered them to take nothing for their journey except a staff, no bread, no bag, no money in their belts. And now here we are. And they came back from that and said, Jesus, this was wonderful and all that. And so now Jesus asks them, for example, okay, guys, what have you got on you? The correct answer should be what?
Nothing.
Nothing. What have they got on them? Who knows? Maybe 200 denarii, but for sure 5 loaves and 2 fish. Now, where'd they get that from? Right? What happened there to the no bag, no money, no nothing? Already, I think, Mark, in this great irony, his little sarcasm, is saying, already, even then, it looks like they kind of carried a little of that feeding themselves mentality with them. Yeah, no bread, no bag, no money, but you know, come on, I need a snack on the way. Right? You know, I'm up here at Holden for 3 weeks. So I'm not going to bring any food with me? Come on. You know what they serve here. No, I want to say the food has been very good. I mean, that's serious. I'm not indicting the food. But we know the little nasty remarks, right?
A glass of wine.
A glass of wine, yeah. Where was the beer with those brats last week? Yeah. Right? But there's all, right, we always carry with us that little feeding ourselves mentality. I mean, truly is God going to provide? Or would we much rather find that verse which is so hard to find in the Bible, God helps those who help themselves? Riley, you know where that's found in the Bible?
That was according to Mother.
Yeah. Hezekiah 3:12. Write that down. You can look that up. Hezekiah 3:12. That's where you'll find it.
So that really shows they did not have complete faith.
Right.
They just...
That there is that sense of God will provide an economics of grace and compassion, the sense that there always will be enough around there for us. Huh, forget that, right? We better take some along for ourselves. Save it up, keep it. And so there again, we have the disciples as the foil, already again that beginning insight into say, their hardness of heart. And we can see that coming through, I think, most graphically when the disciples come up to Jesus and say to him, right, send them away so that they can go into the villages and buy something to eat. Now, at first glance, again, one might think, well, gee, that does seem to be a really compassionate thing to do. You know, the disciples are saying, well, come on, Jesus. They've been out here all day. It's late. You know, send them away so they can get to the 7-Eleven before it closes. Because they weren't open 24 hours back then. They close it. Right? And all of that. And you would say, well, that seems to be rather compassionate. But Jesus even challenges that, because to say, well, maybe that is a compassionate thing to say if your economics and politics is that old style economics and politics where first and foremost you're concerned about feeding yourselves. But the true economics of grace, if you will, when compassion is at work, deals with this differently. And so here then, Jesus' response to that, when the disciples are stymied by all of this, is verses 39 and following, and again, just for the sake of time here to very quickly summarize that, is that Jesus takes the resources that are at hand, organizes the people, blesses those gifts that are there, distributes them, and lo and behold, what happens? Verse 42, and all ate and were filled. Or again, instead of that sense of were filled, I think a better translation of that Greek word would be and were satisfied. They all said, it's enough, it's good. It was there, right? That somehow, right, all of this stuff could happen. That people were fed and were satisfied, given the resources that were there. God can bless and work with what is there, and it will be filling and satisfying. Okay. Let's go to the 4,000 very quickly, and then see if we can get a little stormy crossing as well. The 4,000, chapter 8. Note the way that this starts out. Verses 1 through 3, if someone would read them, please.
In those days, there was again a great crowd without anything to eat. He called his disciples and said to them, I have compassion for the crowd, because they have been with me now for 3 days and have nothing to eat. If I send them away hungry to their homes, they will faint on the way, and some of them have come from a great distance.
Okay. Key here again is the notion of compassion. In some senses, the whole issue of hunger, note on the Gentile side, seems to be escalated. Because over here on the Jewish side, they've only gone 1 day without eating. Over here, they've gone for 3 days without eating. Right? In some senses, already a talk about, note the hunger for the word on that side and that desire. And then how do we handle that? Also, the concern here that even if we send them home, like might have been suggested over on this side, they can't go home here lest they faint on the way. And remember again for Mark that notion of on the way is a way of characterizing the disciple community, right? What kind of nourishment will the community have as it travels on the way, as it's out there in the wilderness? I think here Mark is very purposefully trying to link up, ironically, the Gentile side with the whole Exodus experience. Just as Israel is on the way, journeying in the wilderness toward that promised land, so now we have the Gentiles out there in the wilderness journeying on the way for God's promises. And they too are that Exodus community. Already a sense of inclusivity is at work here and wants to do that. And Jesus says, These people too need to be fed. What are we going to do? Okay? What's the disciples' response? verses 4 and 5. Would someone read that, please?
His disciples replied, "How can one feed these people with bread here in the desert?" He asked them, "How many loaves do you have?" They said, 7.
Okay. Now their answer at least wasn't how, you know, but how are we going to buy it? But how can we feed all these people here in the desert? Again, a question that the doubters within Israel were asking as they were wandering in the wilderness to say, how are we going to eat out here? At that point, God's response to them was manna. At this point, and again, I think drawing back on that manna story and everything, Jesus' response is that our manna too, our loaves come from God, but now that understanding of manna can already arise within the community itself. In terms of the way and in which we live and work with one another. Why do I say that notion of the community itself? We know again how Jesus is going to deal with this. Have the people sit down, bring me what you have, bless it, distribute it. They're all going to eat and be satisfied. But what's going on here? We kind of go to the next story. In verse 11, the Pharisees came and began to argue with Jesus, asking him for a sign from heaven to test him. And he sighed deeply in his spirit and said, "Why does this generation ask for a sign? Truly, I tell you, no sign will be given to this generation." Okay. I think the important thing is note the Pharisees, right, the challengers here, want a sign from heaven. Jesus isn't going to give them any sign from heaven because what has been happening? Where have all the signs been coming from? If you will, I think Mark is saying, because the sign of God's reign and rule is always a sign from earth. From that around us and in history. I mean, what more do you need? 4,000 have been fed. Do you need another sign? 5,000 have been fed. Do you need another sign? The lame walk, the blind see, the deaf hear. What kind of other signs do you want? Remember back in Ezekiel, that understanding of how do you fleece the sheep? Well, because they go hungry and they're poor and they are not fed. And so it is those signs, when those people are taken care of, when that economics and politics of compassion, when justice happens, that is the sign that God's reign and rule is at work among us. You don't need the thunderbolts, if you will, or manna dropping out of heaven. It's happening right around you. Do you have the eyes to see it, the ears to hear it, the hearts to take it in? Or are they all hard? I think that's how Jesus is pushing here on this point. Yes?
Why do you say that's a sign from earth and not from heaven, meaning from Christ, who came from heaven?
Okay, I'm saying that because I think here is the contrast that Jesus is saying all the signs which he does are happening right down here and around him and around us. Right? It's not in that sense supernatural. But it is God working in, to write a Lutheran term, in, with, and under the natural. All that is here around us is used by God through God's compassion and grace and justice to serve all humanity. Right? That's the sign of God at work in our world.
I'm struck by the, so much in Mark, saw it in John, of course. The big switch is happening here from the wilderness Exodus story and these feeding stories. If what you're saying is these disciples were in fact hoarding manna by stuffing their pockets with a little bread, now in the gospel, instead of that rotting and turning to maggots, it's blessed and turned into a just and compassionate feeding of everyone. I'd never thought of that before, but that God is dealing with the hoarding, not by kind of an icky punishment, but by an abundance of grace, saying, so you hoarded it, I can transform even your unfaith, even your self-protection or your self-guarding, self-security making into abundance for other people.
Mm-hmm. Great. I disagree, though. I disagree. I don't think there's a hoarding at all. There's a time lapse between when he said go out without taking all that stuff. And this time, they've been staying in people's homes. They've been, they've been appreciating their hospitality. They're not going to let them out the door without saying, you've got to take a lunch. I can't send you out there without that. And I think that food came from the community itself.
So, it was a
so
gift
I don't see a hoarding there.
So it was a gift of hospitality.
That's what I see.
Okay.
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 In terms of the bread and wine sign from heaven, and then they kind of ascend to the earth, and especially with all of the desert wilderness stuff, this is different than the hoarding piece, but, like where the sign's coming from, back in Deuteronomy, and it's sort of ready to go into the land. First, Moses makes the point that he got the stuff face to face. But then there's that wonderful passage in there that says, so, when you want to know where the Word of God is and where God is, don't ask somebody to go over the sea and get it, or don't ask somebody up to heaven to get it, but the Word is very near you, in your mouth and in your heart, and you can do it. So even for the people of Israel, the Pharisees have heard this Word before from the mouth of Moses. So when Jesus comes and says, look all around you, it's happening right here in your midst. It's the same Word. They should have heard back on the edge of the wilderness though when they were ready to go into the promised land. So it's an echo that matches all this wilderness stuff too.
In response to your reading about this is hospitality and that's why they have the bread and they're not hoarding, if you go with that, I think the question is still there, particularly in the first feeding story. Then why did the disciples tell Jesus, send them away so they can have something to eat? If that would be the case, wouldn't they have said, well, when Jesus said, you feed them, and they would have said, yeah, because, when we left, all these folks sent us all these lunches and all these goodies, here it is. But they didn't volunteer it, at least as the way Mark presents it. So that there seems to be even that sense if they had those things out of hospitality, which is an interesting reading. I didn't think of that either. But still, if they have that, there still seems to be some kind of hoarding going on, or at least the reluctance to give it up. So that they might have even gotten it in a noble way, but there still seems to be that reluctance to give it up.
But sometimes if our experience hasn't told us that small amount, it's like, what difference can my little make? Chance to say that this could feed that. Sometimes, later on down the line when you've seen what God can do with your little one, we join it together, then we're more likely to do to say, yeah, I think that this can make a difference, but maybe their experience hadn't shown them.
If we would be reading this story in Matthew, the disciples come, they say, well, we've got nothing. I mean, that notion there of experience. Jesus' response to that is, oh, you of little faith. That whatever we have, if we just simply say, oh, you know, who am I? My salary? Can I do it? I mean, I've got nothing. Right? The response to that is little faith one, or practically faithless one. We're not talking here, again, as soon as we start thinking about, well, do I have the right quantity, and quantity somehow means power and the ability to do so, right? That's old style, that's our dominant way of talking about economics. And this is, again, precisely what I think these stories want to undercut. We're not talking about power, prestige, leadership in any of our standard and typical categories.
Well, then what do you make of chapter 8 when just it seems like just last week or 2 days ago we fed 5,000, now we've got 4, and in chapter or verse 4 and 8, in chapter 8 it says the disciples answered him, well, how do we feed these men with bread here in the desert? You would think that they would be saying, oh yeah, last week we, let's see what happens this time. But instead they're, well, which sort of makes me wonder if the disciples are just a device at that point for Mark to make a point. Because you would think that they would say, let's go. It worked last time.
Yeah, I mean, obviously these are literary characterizations. They're a literary device. But on the other hand, and this is a question you don't have to answer, Nancy, have you ever done anything stupid twice? And I know none of us have ever done that.
Yes, she has.
You two can work that out later. Right? I mean, I think there, I mean, the point, yeah. On the one hand, these are parallel stories, if you will. One kind of working with Jewish understandings and things to do with community. One with Gentile understandings and community, bringing them together. We could go into the, you know, 4,000, 12 baskets, 7 baskets, and all the symbolism of numbers that goes with that. But the understanding there is that the disciples, whether working within the community in which they're more familiar, or whether working with true strangers out there in Gentile territory, it didn't make any difference. They just didn't get it. Right? They couldn't practice the economics of compassion at home, and they couldn't practice it away either. They're just dummies.
And even if they were given the food, say on the way there by being guests, they immediately say, do we need to spend 200 something, $1 on bread?
Yeah.
So they must have taken money.
Yeah,
usually people don't give money on, you know, they might give you a lunch, but they don't usually give you $10.
Yeah. The question there is a little ambiguous. We're not quite sure whether the disciples had the 200 denarii or whether they're saying, like, well, Jesus, where do you expect us to come up with 200 denarii? It's kind of but either way, it does show that the way they think you can handle the situation is the old economics as you. I mean, if you can't handle it the way our economic system says you can handle it, then we're at a loss, right? Gee, we've hit the bottom. We've hit the wall. What do we do now?
We're going to incorporate the concept of miraculous and supernatural then into this very human event.
I think that in the way Mark wants to present this, again, he's not concentrating this so much on the miraculous as with regard to something out of heaven happening again, but simply the kind of understanding that when God's compassion is at work and people are moved by that, there is enough for all. And we can see that at work in that sense, for Mark, the miraculous thing here is that people behave compassionately with one another. And there is enough for all. Right? Because a typical miracle story would again have somehow a very specific mechanism and device about what happened. I mean, you know, like, Jesus is going to touch the person, or Jesus puts his fingers in the deaf man's ears, or whatever. There's nothing here that kind of fits the pattern of a traditional miracle story. That Mark's emphasis here is, look at how, if you will, miraculously, God's compassion works in community. When people practice this, when people who are moved by God's compassion are compassionate, isn't it miraculous what the results are? I think that's the way Mark wants us to look at this story and understand it. Reason for that, again, the compassionless onslaught of time. We got to go here to the end. Chapter 8, verse 14. And here I have a little quibble with Bruce Metzger and company in terms of their translation of the NRSV. Verse 14 says, "Now the disciples had forgotten to bring any bread, and they had only one loaf with them in the boat." The word for bread and loaf is the same word in the Greek. And I think it's very important because Mark is making a point here between loaves, the plural, and loaf, the singular. So if you will, my reading here is, "Now the disciples had forgotten to bring any loaves, and they had only one loaf with them in the boat." Now let's just jump down then to verse 16. "They were discussing..." Here's my translation here. "And they were discussing with one another, saying, 'We have no loaves.'" I mean, I think, again, kind of Mark's irony here is there, you know, here they are all in the boat, and they're going, there aren't any loaves here. Peter, I thought you were going to bring the bread. Oh, I thought you were going to bring the bread, John. I don't always have to bring the bread. Andrew, it's your turn to bring the bread, right?" And so they're, right, the typical, on the one hand, they were always arguing, who's the greatest among us? Now they're in the boat arguing who was supposed to bring the loaves, plural, right? So they're arguing that. And verse 17 then, "And Jesus, perceiving this," becoming aware of that, "says to them, 'Why are you talking about having no loaves? And then, do you still not perceive or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Do you have eyes and fail to see? Do you have ears and fail to hear?'" Right? Echoes there of chapter 4, verses 10 through 12. Only now it's not the outsiders who have hard hearts and sclerotic eyes and ossified eardrums. It's the disciples. The folks who should really know don't understand. And then the thing, "And do you not remember?" And I think the important thing here is this is one of the few Eucharistic moments in Mark's gospel. I think he really wants to emphasize, they're arguing about loaves, and Mark is saying, come on folks, come on community, you have the one loaf. Right? That Eucharistic loaf, right? "Don't you remember?" And kind of hear a foreshadowing of that one loaf, "Do this in remembrance of me," that this whole notion now of remembering is going both backwards and forwards at this point in Mark's gospel. Remembering going backwards all the way to the Exodus and the wilderness experience. I mean, can't you remember the whole history where God has always provided us with loaves? And also looking ahead to that Last Supper and beyond, don't you remember how God always provides us? How do we always keep that in mind? How do we center ourselves in terms of an economics and politics of compassion? By remembering. And so here again, a little humor. Mark says, okay, or Mark has Jesus say, give him a quick quiz. When I broke the five loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets full of broken did? 12. When I did it for the 7, how many? 7. Right, okay, so they got the right answer. Now the question is, do you not yet understand? Implied answer, because we have to keep going on the go. Nope, they don't get it. They don't get it because they don't remember. And so now here comes the quiz.
Where'd you get that out of here?
Wonderbread.
Of course, it must be Wonderbread. So as, you know, if you can make as many as possible, try to get a quiz sheet there. And my question to you is, you look at that and think about that bread in the context here of our stories. My question is, do you get it? Take a look at that fine, white, sliced bread. Bread to die for, right? Do you get it? Or what do you get? What does our typical bread tell us about ourselves and our economics and politics of compassion?